From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Fact and fiction in American politics. Hello again, I'm Oren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Nobody should be surprised when politicians distort the facts or tell outright lies. Now, fact-checkers are promising to give voters the truth. But the fact-checkers themselves are critiqued from the right and the left. They're accused of choosing the facts they check according to hidden agendas. Does one side lie more than the other? Do the media add to the confusion by trying to find balance between the two? Or are the facts what voters really want to know? If so, why do they sometimes cling to beliefs in proven falsehoods? We'll hear more about that today. On Reporters' Notebooks later on, new violins and old masters. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney back with To the Point. In this age of political polarization, fact-checkers promise to help voters sort out the fact from the fiction. Can the fact-checkers themselves be trusted? Are some questions too complicated for right or wrong answers? Will voters create their own realities, whatever the facts might be? On Reporter's Notebook, should a new violin really play second fiddle to a Stradivarius or a Guarnarius? First, this news update. The Taliban ruled Afghanistan from 1996 till the U.S.-led NATO campaign of 2001, but it's been fighting back ever since. It says it won't negotiate with the Karzai administration until foreign troops have withdrawn. But today, it announced the opening of an office in Qatar, specifically to begin talks with the United States. Ernesto Londano is based in Kabul for The Washington Post. Ernesto Londano, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
To what extent does this appear to be an offer to negotiate about long-term issues? To what extent does it have to do with prisoner swap because of the Taliban forces now being held at Guantanamo Bay?
Well, the issue of a prisoner swap or the release of prisoners in Guantanamo Bay is the only concrete issue that the Taliban have conveyed in the statement. What's really significant about it is it's the first time that the group has indicated that it is interested in speaking to Washington, that it wants to actually sit down and talk to them. We know that there have been discussions in the past, very preliminary discussions that appear to have yielded nothing, but the Taliban has until now denied that it even engaged in these talks. So by coming out today in a statement that very publicly outlines its desire to talk to Washington, it's really breaking ground with the past, and it's saying that it sees potential in talking to a government that it has disparaged for years as an occupying force and as being led by infidels.
The United States has said no talks unless the Karzai government is involved. The announcement today by the Taliban didn't even mention the Karzai government.
That's right. That was perhaps the most striking part about the statement is it said that the two key stakeholders in the resolution of the Afghan conflict are the Taliban and the United States and its international allies. It was very clear that that the Taliban has little regard for the Afghan government. In fact, the Afghan government peace council, which was put together about a year and a half ago to try to reach a peace deal with the Taliban, didn't have any knowledge about this deal. Representatives of this committee said they only had secondhand accounts about the preparations for this Qatar office. And interestingly, President Karzai's office today offered no comment on this statement, which indicates possibly that they have been left in the dark.
On the other hand, the Obama administration has been hoping for a negotiated deal. They want to get the troops out of there.
That is correct. I think there are varying views within the United States government about whether a peace deal is the way to go, whether this is the right time for talks, or whether you should step up military efforts and try to weaken the Taliban before trying to get them to the negotiating table. But I think if you look at it through a political prism, I think the administration is interested in showing that there is a turning point in this war that has dragged out for more than a decade, that there might be good news in sight, that there might be a political resolution, and that there might be a political process underway that could make the administration's promise of drawing down troops over the next couple of years feasible and not really messy or violent.
Back to what you said was the only concrete issue that has been mentioned, the Guantanamo Bay detainees. How many are they? Are there, rather, and do the Taliban have any detainees that they could trade?
Well, there are, I think, five individual names that have been raised in news reports as people that the Taliban is very interested in getting back and getting out of Guantanamo Bay. And their only real apparent bargaining chip is an American soldier that was kidnapped in 2009. He is reported to be in the custody of a Taliban-affiliated group. And if these talks were to get serious, and if the Americans were to really have an interest in seeing whether they can take a preliminary step to build trust, you could potentially see a prisoner swap. However, it's important to note that we really don't have any evidence that these discussions have gone far, and we don't know, for example, how people in Congress and other people who might have a vote in the way this is done and the way this is handled are going to react to this.
Very quickly, why Qatar? Why that location?
Well, we can only speculate about that because Qatar has been very quiet on this matter. It hasn't really acknowledged that it is a player in it. But it's a very small country which has a very good relationship with the United States, and it's also a very conservative Islamic country. It's got a very good intelligence service. So conceivably, you know, if you have a handful of Taliban envoys operating there, it could be easy to keep them on a close leash, on a tight leash, so to speak. It is a country that the Taliban would probably, you know, feel comfortable with ideologically because they're religiously sort of see eye to eye.
Okay.
And it's also a country the United States, I think, feels comfortable doing business with.
Ernesto Londoño, again, Washington Post correspondent, reporting to us from Kabul. Thank you very much. In a moment, fact and fiction in American politics on To The Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and I'll be back with To The Point. In 2007, the St. Petersburg Times introduced a feature called PolitiFact to assess the accuracy of statements made by politicians. It's complete with a truthometer with a range from true through mostly true to mostly false, and finally, pants on fire. PolitiFact, joined the Annenberg Political Center's FactCheck.org. Now, the Washington Post for the past year has a regular feature called the Fact Checker. And the Fact Checker himself is Glenn Kessler, who's reported on foreign policy, economic policy, the White House, and Congress as well. Glenn Kessler, it's good to have you on our program.
Glad to be with you.
Tell us about the Fact Checker. What do you do? What's the mission?
The mission is to assess the statements made by politicians. I write five times a week. And I should note, we actually had a version of this in 2007, started in 2007, but it only ran through the 2008 campaign. And I resurrected it last year with a broader mandate to look not just at the people running for president, but the statements made by members of Congress and other politicians, even diplomats, though I don't get as much chance to do that these days.
Isn't this what reporters are supposed to do in the first place?
Yes, entirely. And in fact, they do it. What the advantage of these fact-checking columns is that I'm able to take a particular statement. So, for instance, Mitt Romney today said that he created more jobs when he was governor of Massachusetts than Barack Obama has created for the entire country as president. Now, that's the kind of line that would get tossed into a political story. It might be there in the third or fourth paragraph. There might be a comment, you know, by the writer about how true or false it is. What I can do is I can take that particular statement and really spend a lot of time drilling deeply into how true or not it is. And in fact, you know, I started doing these. You mentioned all the beats I did. I mean, I've been doing this ever since I've been covering things in Washington. In 1996, I did one of the very first newspaper fact checks when I was working for Newsday, and that was born of my frustration as a political writer for Newsday, where I was covering Bill Clinton and Bob Dole and found I didn't have the time or space in the news stories to fully vet the kinds of things they were saying.
Well, when you're talking about who creates more jobs as governor or as president, aren't you to some extent talking apples and oranges, the federal government as opposed to the state government? Don't you get into problems as to how you actually determine whether a governor or a president is in a position to create any jobs in the first place?
Exactly right. I mean, that's what I mean, I have not written a column on that statement. I'm thinking of doing it. But these are the, some of the, this is the kind of thing that I could get into in a, that you couldn't really get into in a regular political news article. I could lay out, first of all, what are the facts? How many jobs have been created since Barack Obama became president? Secondly, is it fair to start from January 20th, when he became president, in the midst of the worst recession since the Great Depression, when none of his policies had taken effect? It does it make more sense to base it from when the stimulus took effect or not? Then secondly, yeah, I mean, he's president. He can't suddenly conjure up jobs just as much as a governor can necessarily either. In fact, one of the knocks on Mitt Romney by his Republican opponents is that his job record of Massachusetts was not very good. So, and then I can lay all that out in a column. And what I do at the end of my column is I rate the statements and I assign a number of Pinocchios. You mentioned what PolitiFact does. I will give anywhere from 1 to 4 Pinocchios, with 4 Pinocchios being essentially the equivalent of their pants on fire.
Okay. You mentioned something that was said by Mitt Romney today. Here's something that was said on CBS by Newt Gingrich. First, we'll hear the host ask a question.
Are you calling Mitt Romney a liar?
Yes. It's just like his pretense that he's a conservative. Here's a Massachusetts moderate who has tax-paid abortions in Romney Care, puts Planned Parenthood in Romney Care, raises hundreds of millions of dollars of taxes on businesses, appoints liberal judges to appease Democrats, and wants the rest of us to believe somehow he's magically a conservative.
Back again, Glenn Kessler of the Fact Checker in the Washington Post. Is that something you could tackle?
Well, there are several elements there. There's the question of, is Romney lying? In the context here, Gingrich was talking about the fact that Romney has been, surrogates of Romney have been attacking Newt Gingrich with very tough ads, and Romney has been, kind of said, well, I don't really have much to do with those ads because it's an independent group. And I looked at one of those ads, and it was a kitchen sink type thing against Gingrich, and I actually gave that particular ad 4 Pinocchios. Now, the second part of that statement was a series of charges that Gingrich made about Romney, not all of which I've checked out, but again, that's something I could tackle, and I will occasionally do that, where I take each statement and then I go through and say, well, here's the true facts. I mean, I don't know I'd have to research, for instance, what were the abortion rules that came about as part of Romney's health care plan, and how much of that was Romney's doing and how much of that was the Democratic legislature. You know, at the time, Romney was said he would uphold the laws of Massachusetts with regards to abortion, so he may not have had much choice in terms of deciding to do that.
Okay. Glenn Kessler with the Fact Checker column at the Washington Post. Mark Hemingway is the online editor at the Conservative Weekly Standard. He's written a piece that caused a lot of attention, headlined Lies, Damned Lies, and Fact Checking. Mark Hemingway, good to have you on our program. What's wrong with what Glenn Kessler and the other fact checkers are doing? Mark Hemingway, can you hear me? We seem to be having trouble getting to Mark Hemingway. Let me go back to Glenn Kessler.
Okay.
You're aware that Mr. Hemingway has said that what we perhaps ought to do is have better reporting in the first place. And secondly, when opinions are uttered by one politician or another, just let opinions be opinions.
Right. I read his piece. It's funny. I could hear him. I don't know why he couldn't be heard. But
well, let me try him again. Mark Hemingway, can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now?
There you go. Yes. Thank
okay.
you. Finally, we apparently had a technical problem, and sorry about that. So, first question. What's wrong with all this?
Look, I'm not against fact-checking in the abstract. I mean, if a politician says something that's, you know, concrete, you know, like, you know, throws out a number or something like that, and it can be verified one way or the other, I have no problem with that. The problem I have is that frequently fact-checking, as it's practiced by the major fact-checking organizations, is they, you know, they fact-check opinions by politicians, or they, you know, they overcomplicate things, and they try and drill down on specifics when it's very obvious what the, in terms of the intent of what the politician was saying. Like, you know, I'll give you a good example. One that I threw at my piece was that the AP fact-checked something by Tim Pawlenty, and they fact-checked the statement that Obamacare is unconstitutional. Now, regardless of what you think about the, you know, the particulars of the president's health care law, I mean, that's clearly an opinion. Not only that, when Pawlenty wrote that, he wrote that in the opinion section of USA Today, where it says opinion in bold letters above it. And yet they concluded that it was unfair to, for Tim Pawlenty to say this because courts were divided on whether or not the law is constitutional based on what we've seen in the legal proceedings so far. Never mind that, you know, what is or is not constitutional gets into legal theory in terms of judicial supremacy and other things like that. But I just think that, you know, frequently you get these cases where, you know, the fact-checking organizations are really biting off more than they can chew and attempt to verify things that shouldn't be verified. It's clearly opinion.
Why shouldn't things be verified?
Look, I'm all in favor of things being verified. It's just, you know, you can't, you know, verify opinion. You know, Obamacare is unconstitutional is an opinion that, you know, until, you know, maybe the Supreme Court settles it one way or the other, that is, you know, perfectly valid to hold. You may not agree with it, but, you know, it's certainly, you know, not the fact checker's, you know, responsibility to come in and say, well wait a minute, that's not true, which is what happens, particularly because of the way fact checking is done. You know, like they all tend to have their own little rating scales and you know, and like you point out, yes, it is kind of cute and all that, but it does come off as an air of like sort of pseudoscientific objectivity here. Like, oh, well, this is false and this is not, you know, we're going to rate it on the scale of how, you know, true or false it is. I mean, there's no, you know, specific way to quantify how true it is. I mean, it's an entirely subjective judgment.
Back to Glenn Kessler. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I completely agree that we should not be in the business of checking opinions. And there are a number of columns I will do where I don't assign Pinocchios, which I agree is, you know, one could argue is a bit of a marketing gimmick. But it also, I do find it useful to kind of keep things straight in my own mind. But the, you know, and so I will just try to provide context for statements or do a kind of type of analysis, and there's no particular rating at the end. I do find that readers preferred when I come down and make some sort of judgment. But like I said, I try not to fact-check opinions. I may have fallen short on that occasionally. We all make mistakes, but that is certainly one of my New Year's resolutions, in part thanks to Mark's piece, because I think he raised some you know, good issues. There are, I feel much more comfortable if you know, for instance, this Romney statement on jobs. You know, there are numbers there. One can check. You can look up. You know, number of jobs lost since Obama became president was 1.8 million. Then you have to make some judgments about how much you blame that on Obama and how much you blame that on Obama's policies. And, you know, I think you can make judgments there without necessarily checking opinions. But, if you know, and if you can't fact-check the statement, you know, raising taxes is going to hurt the economy. I mean, you can call economists, but, you know, I try to avoid delving into arguments among economists. And that's a case where I would just leave it up to the readers to decide.
Mark Hemingway, back to you. You're with the Weekly Standard. That's a conservative organization. You've indicated you think that the fact checkers also have done more fact checking of Republicans than they have of Democrats. Are you suggesting that in some way there's a liberal bias behind this?
Well, yeah. I mean, but the thing is, you know, again, if we're going to drill down into the facts here. I mean, I'm not just suggesting that. University of Minnesota Humphrey School of Public Affairs actually surveyed PolitiFact, and they looked at 500 PolitiFact stories from January 2010 to January 2011. And in total, 74 of the 98 statements that they judged false, and this is just PolitiFact, not Glenn Kessler or any other fact checkers, but 74 of the 98 statements that they rated false were given to Republicans, you know. And look, I mean, I am willing to accept the idea that, you know, maybe for whatever reason, depending on who's in the news or whatever, that, you know, one party obviously is not going to be an even split. You know, one party might be judged to be more unfair in terms of their characterization of events than the other. But 3-1, that seems to be like an awfully high ratio there. You know, you can believe, you know, basically, you know, that Republicans lie three times as often as Democrats, or that at a minimum, PolitiFact is engaging in, I'd say, you know, some pretty obvious, you know, selection bias.
On the other hand, PolitiFact said the biggest lie of the year was the Democrats' claim that the Republican plan to change the Ryan plan for Medicare would, in fact, change Medicare as we know it. That's pretty much the other direction.
Well, yeah, except for the fact that I think that I'm actually that there were howls of protests from the left, and PolitiFact did that. And I'm actually sympathetic to those protests. I think that, you know, when people say that Paul Ryan's plan is going to, you know, change Medicare as we know it or end Medicare, I mean, you know, again, these things are highly subjective. And if you have to drill down to the specifics of what Paul Ryan's plan does and doesn't do.
Glenn Kessler, back to you quickly, if you will. You said that readers want to have judgments. Why do you think that is? What kind of reaction do you get? And do you get it from liberals as well as conservatives?
Yes, I get equally trashed by liberals and conservatives. I'm either, depending on what I write from day to day, I'm either totally in the tank for the conservatives or I'm a liberal weenie. And, you know, it kind of goes with the territory. I mean, I did check this year. I always do an accounting for my readers. In the past year, I did 100 fact checks of Democrats, 104 of Republicans. It tended to be the ratings on average were slightly more higher for Republicans, but I think that was mainly because of the Republican nomination race and people like Michelle Bachmann. But, you know, I having covered Washington politics for 30 years, I find there's really no difference between Democrats or Republicans in terms of when it serves their needs, wanting to twist the truth to make their point. And so I look at each statement completely holistically. And I don't care who said it. I just try to drill down and see what the facts are.
All right. Glenn Kessler, once again, with the fact checker at the Washington Post, Mark Hemingway, online editor at the Weekly Standard. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation after we take a very brief break. On Reporter's Notebook, are new violins really as good as the old masters? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
We're only back with To the Point, talking today about fact-checking as a phenomenon in political coverage, something in addition to the kind of thing that the reporters do on a routine basis. Many people think that the rise of fact-checking is a result of how partisan politics have become. David Greenberg is a professor of history, journalism, and media studies at Rutgers University. He's author of a forthcoming book on presidential spin. He writes for publications including Slate, the New York Times Book Review, and the op-ed pages of the Los Angeles Times. David Greenberg, good to have you on our program.
And thanks for having me on.
What's your take on fact-checking?
Well, you know, in a way, I agree with both your guests. I do think it's worthwhile to have reporters trying to sort of determine the truth of many of these claims that get tossed about on the campaign trail and in our kind of fast-moving, you know, political discourse. That certain statements can often pass unchecked into our discussions, and it's good to say, wait a minute, is this true? And so on. On the other hand, I also agree with Mark Hemingway that a lot of the time when I see, I'm not talking about Glenn Kessler necessarily, but there are a number of these fact-checking enterprises, and I see a lot of them where I do think they're either checking opinions or rendering judgments that just seem to me to be way off base, you know, where somebody has said something the gist of which is perfectly clear, and maybe someone was a little inartful in some of their word choice, but gets pegged as a liar or as making a false statement. You know, I remember Mitt Romney 4 years ago said he remembered seeing his father march with Martin Luther King. And, you know, this brought on howls of protest because George Romney had never actually marched with Martin Luther King. Well, that's clearly not what Mitt Romney was saying. He was saying that his father had been a supporter of King, that he had been out there on the front lines for civil rights. And whether he was physically next to Martin Luther King or not really wasn't the point. I've seen this happen to Democrats. I've seen this happen to Republicans. I don't think it's a matter of liberal bias or conservative bias. I think it's the fact that inevitably with many of these questions, you get into very subjective judgments.
So back to Glenn Kessler on that. You've pretty well conceded that point, it seems to me. How do you try, at least, to avoid that?
You know, I have my own kind of matrix that I look at when I examine statements. But for instance, if I will judge more harshly a statement that was made as part of a prepared speech, which meant that the politician thought about it in a particular way and probably discussed it with staff as to whether they were going to use that particular fact or statistic, versus something that is just made off the cuff in a TV interview or, you know, in a campaign rally or something like that. Also, you know, there are a number of times when I will contact people and they will say, you know, we misspoke. You know, we didn't mean to say this, we meant to say that. And that makes a difference as well, too.
But do they have to then publicly concede that before you give them a Pinocchio?
Well, it would certainly help if they've said, you know, I made a mistake and I misspoke. And sometimes I'm convinced not to do a column or anything like that. I do think that having, to get back to one of your original questions, I view it as a supplement. It's not a replacement for traditional reporting. It's a supplement. And I do know from conversations I've had with members of Congress who have contacted me to avoid getting Pinocchios and that sort of thing, that they are more careful about some of the things they say and how they say it because they want, you know, so I kind of feel in a small way we're helping bring a little more candor to our political discussion. I try not to play gotcha, certainly.
Okay, Glenn Kessler, the Fact Checker column for The Washington Post. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
You're welcome.
David Greenberg, back to you at Rutgers University. You've quoted Hannah Arendt as saying, politics and truth have never had an easy relationship. Shouldn't we, as I think both of our other guests have said, simply assume that we're going to see a lot of twisting of the facts as time goes on? And is the question always whether or not the facts are correct rather than whether the general point is effective?
Well, sure, exactly. I mean, I think that quote is a nice quote because there's often an undercurrent in a lot of our journalism and political discussion. And these politicians are lying to us. And obviously politicians do sometimes lie kind of, you know, in a premeditated way, you know, tell falsehoods that they hope will deceive us. Most of the time, though, when we perceive something as a lie, it's because we sort of disagree with its implications. We feel it's misleading, and this gets us into this much murkier world of spin. And spin, or sort of selective presentation of facts and phrasing of facts, is part of political argument. You know, it goes back to Plato, who wrote about rhetoric. And Plato thought all rhetoric was bad because its aim was not to get to the truth. Philosophy did that, but rhetoric was simply to produce conviction, right or wrong. And Aristotle was much more forgiving and said, you know, rhetoric can be good or bad depending the purposes to which it's put. So there have been these debates about rhetoric or, you know, propaganda or spin or whatever you want to call it, but we've never had politicians whose job it is to be like an Associated Press reporter and just kind of give a string of facts and leave it to the audience to interpret. We want politicians to lead, to use rhetoric, to give arguments. And of necessity, you know, that will strike some people as misleading and as untrue. But to get into realms of absolute truth or of lying, you know, to me, usually misses the point.
Is the rise of fact-checking by the mainstream media an effort to sort of get back in the game when the political dialogue has been so taken over by partisan organizations on both ends of the political spectrum?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, 100 or more years ago, newspapers were kind of openly partisan organs. You know, an account by a Republican paper of an event would just read very differently from a Democratic newspaper's account of the same event. In the course of the 20th century, you had the development of objectivity as an ideal for what we now call the mainstream media. That doesn't mean all reporters were perfectly objective, but the professional incentives from readers, from colleagues, from advertisers, from all of it was to aspire to try to get a news that everybody could put their trust in. In recent years, or even the last couple of decades, with the rise of talk radio, cable news, internet blogs, we've seen much more cocooning of opinion so that people get their news from sources that are more like those 19th century organs, openly partisan. They make no pretense about their political viewpoint. And I think we still have a need for mainstream journalism that doesn't try to take sides, that tries to get the facts right. But as Walter Lippmann said, as soon as this objective journalism was developing, that's always a hard job. You know, it's one thing to get the box score correct, or the weather, or the closing of the Dow Jones average. Those things are, you know, quite easily verifiable. But many facts, you know, soon take you into the world of interpretation and analysis and opinion, and can't be so easily distilled as simply true or simply false.
Back to Mark Hemingway at the Weekly Standard, author of Lies, Damned Lies, and Fact Checking. Do you agree that the subjectivity now of much of the media does require some sort of objective checking mechanism?
Well, I think objectivity as an ideal, you know, certainly has its place, and I think that there's been a lot of people actually on both sides that are, you know, quick to, you know, one, destroy the mainstream media and speak of it very derisively, you know, as if, you know, we've somehow outgrown this notion of objectivity. You know, again, though, I guess the problem is, though, that we still have a fundamental problem here, which is that I think that there's a lot of supposedly objective outlets that aren't nearly as objective as they would like to believe. You know,
is that true on both sides?
I think that's true on both sides, but I think it's also true that the American media is predominantly liberal, and I don't think that, you know, to varying degrees, you know, like the Washington Post, you know, very obviously has a, you know, center left tilt. It's not so, you know, brazenly partisan that I think that it completely destroys the notion that it's an objective paper, but you do have to take that into account when reading it, for instance. So it just, you know, the problem is it's a very confusing media landscape for a lot of readers, and it gets very sort of frustrating because, you know, you can sort of detect, you know, or think you can detect, you know, biases and all those things, and there's no, like, clear objective yardstick to sort it out.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I need to move ahead before we run out of time. Mark Hemingway, we don't have Glenn Klesser with us any longer to defend the Washington Post as either not center-left or whatever he would want to say about it. And I want to move on to another issue before we run short of time. Bill Bishop is co-editor of the DailyYonder.com. That's an online news source for rural communities. He's author of the book, The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of America is Tearing Us Apart. And Bill Bishop, it's good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
Do you think that voters in general really want to know the facts, or are they making political decision based on something else?
Yeah, well, I mean, the decision's already been made for most people. That's one of the things that just drives political scientists crazy, that you see all sorts of reports about the vast undecided electorate out there, and between Republicans and Democrats, basically, there isn't a vast undecided group. Most people have decided which party, which team they're voting for, and so I began to wonder what effect this fact-checking might have.
What about the decline to state?
What about the decline of what?
The decline to state vote has risen in most states, hasn't it? And that's why people are saying there's a vast undecided group out there.
Well, when you start asking people and getting underneath their how they describe themselves, people who all but about 8, maybe 10% of the electorate are allegedly voting either Republican or Democratic in a presidential election. So there just isn't that much. People have made up their minds about which team they're supporting, and they'll change. Robert Putnam, in his new book, American Grace, finds that they will even change their religious affiliation in order to conform with their politics. People will change their notions of their ideas about particular issues, abortion and gun control laws, in order to maintain affinity and relationship with the party that they've chosen. So facts may have something to do with politics, but not a whole lot.
Well, how do they base their what do they base their decisions on if it's not fact?
Well, the decision's already been made. I mean, most people are the real decision, the real effort in politics is how do you generate enthusiasm among your group, and that, I think that's something that David was getting into, and that's what modern politicians do is they try to make people see themselves in that political candidacy.
Bill Bishop, again, co-editor of the DailyYonder.com. David Greenberg, back to you at Rutgers University. What about the fact that a very substantial number of people in the United States still believe that Barack Obama was not born in this country, even though he finally did release the long-form birth evidence, which seems on an objective basis to end the conversation?
Right. Look, there are lots of examples we can get into where I think objective reporting or reporting, as I have phrased it, that aspires to objectivity, where these fact-checking type columns by people who are in good faith trying to give something that's not a partisan line, can be very valuable. And I think anybody who's interested can, you know, check out the information available about Obama's birth certificate and, you know, see that this birtherism stuff is a lot of nonsense. So clearly there are these kind of cognitive mechanisms for various emotional reasons. People will filter out information that violates certain predetermined beliefs, and it takes a hell of a lot of evidence to convince them otherwise. In some ways, though, that's a very different kind of question than sort of these much more legitimately gray areas of interpretation, where I think all kinds of perspectives other than one's political affiliation kind of enter into it. I mean, you know, it may be that we are very much aligned with a liberal and democratic worldview or a more conservative Republican one. But if you're looking at differences among Republican presidential candidates, well, then, you know, there are a lot of differences that don't really come down to policy differences or places on a political spectrum. And so adjudicating, you know, a difference between Romney and Gingrich is something that where, you know, traditionally described political bias as to say partisan bias, you know, doesn't enter into it in the same way.
Bill Bishop, back to you. You say that people are willing to change their religion in order to make it conform to other kinds of decisions that they have already made. They have already. I thought that the one of the main characteristics of the political of people politically now was that they don't want to compromise.
That's right, and so they change their in order to. And so they don't compromise their religion. They change their religion in order to conform with their political affiliation.
So their political affiliation is more important then? Is it a key to their identity?
That's what Putnam found, and some other political scientists have found that people will actually change what they say they believe in order to remain with the group. The group is that powerful. So churches, you'll see, will switch. You see this in a number of churches, and churches will go conservative in one direction, and another church of the same denomination will go liberal in the other direction, and people will switch and sort among those churches in order to be with their tribe. And but I think what you say about compromise is absolutely right, is people don't want to compromise. They want others to compromise, but they're not willing to compromise that much themselves.
So how do you reconcile those two things then? They seem to me to be different. And are you suggesting that politics is so basic to our personal identity that we're willing to change everything else to conform to it rather than the other way around?
I think that's the purpose of politics now is for us to describe our identity and we want all those things to line up, because this isn't a question about compromising and juggling issues and facts among groups and coming to the decision that is best for the country. It's really coming to a decision that best describes ourselves, and that I think is what David is saying, is you've seen these people juggle among the Republican candidates that are left in the field, trying to find that person that sort of represents them, because the policy differences among them, you know, are they're there, but they're not that great.
Are you saying the facts then don't matter?
Well, between Republicans and Democrats, when that vote comes, it's hard to see where the issues and facts matter that much. No.
Mark Hemingway, quickly, we're short of time, but your take on what we're hearing from Bill Bishop.
I'm sorry, he was cutting out there. Could you just refresh me?
Yeah, he's saying that that politics is now essential to our tribe, and that we identify with political parties first of all, and then change other things in order to accord to them, and that essentially the facts don't matter.
Yeah, no, I think that that's true. You know, what I was saying before is, I mean, I think objectivity does have its functions, and, you know, certainly we have to agree on some facts, you know, that we can have opinions about, you know, to begin with. You know, otherwise those opinions are irrelevant. And we're moving, you know, further and further apart. It's just, the question is when journalism tries to do endeavors like fact checking and things like that, you know, focus in on objectivity, the question is, are they doing more harm than good? And I think that often in these cases they're doing more harm than they should.
So, David Greenberg, quickly back to you, 30 seconds left. Are people really looking then for candidates that are like them, regardless of what the facts are?
Well, you know, I mean, I would challenge this idea that the facts don't matter. I mean, that to me is just putting it too strongly and almost a bit, you know, provocatively. Yes, people do look for candidates they feel are like them, that speak to their values, that represent their values. But there are also lots of ways that new information does change people's voter preferences. Newt Gingrich says he was a victim of negative advertising, which is true, but it was also negative advertising that presented people with information that they didn't know before that made them look less kindly on him. So facts, information does matter. How it's presented also matters. But people are not so incapable of thought or reflection or changing their mind that we simply kind of filter out everything.
Thank you all very much for being on this very interesting program. David Greenberg at Rutgers University, Bill Bishop at DailyYonder.com, Mark Hemingway with the Weekly Standard, Glenn Kessler, the fact checker at the Washington Post. Good to have all of you with us on our program today. Violins made centuries ago by Stradivari or Guarnari del Gesù can bring millions of dollars. Do they really sound all that much better than instruments being made today? We'll hear about a recent test using master violinists, and even they don't agree on the findings. Back in a moment with To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_kcrw.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Claudia Fritz is a French expert on the acoustics of violins. At an international competition in Indianapolis, she persuaded several musicians to play 6 classic and modern instruments wearing goggles so they couldn't see which was which. Then she asked them which they would most like to take home. Claudia Fritz, thank you very much for being on our program today. Tell us, if you will, what kind of results you got when you asked these musicians, having played both the classic kind and the modern kind, which they would like to take home.
Well, so out of 21 players, 13 actually chose the modern violins, which was not so surprising for the team, but probably surprising for most people.
So, in other words, they chose the modern violins that have been made recently rather than those classic ones that have been that have very high prices.
Yes, indeed. And so the question was, which one would you like to take home, meaning which one would you like, you know, which one do you enjoy playing and which one would you like to try it further, you know, at home with friends in different concert hall or in an orchestra. And so that's something they do usually at a violin workshop where they will try different violins and we'll maybe borrow one at the end for a few weeks.
So they decided then that they'd rather have the modern ones than those that sell for $10 million, $15 million?
Yes, but of course they didn't know. They didn't know at all what they were playing.
So this should be good news for young musicians who want to get good violins.
Yes, and it's good news for modern makers, I mean living makers, who can, earn a lot of money now.
Let me introduce Nicholas Wade. He's a science reporter for The New York Times, author of the book The Faith Instinct, about the evolution of religious behavior. Very different subject, but he is a science reporter. Nicholas Wade, good to have you on our program. You talked with Earl Carlos, one of the people that Claudia Fritz tested. He had a critique of her experiment. Tell us about it.
Well, like other violinists, he feels that violinists develop a very personal relationship with their instrument, and one that wishes sort of hard for them to judge on a sort of quick audition. So in particular, they need to test how a violin projects into the audience, which you can't hear if you're playing yourself. You need to get a friend to tell you. And that is something that it wasn't possible for Claudia to do in the conditions of the hotel room and in which she was working.
What about that, Claudia Fritz? You tested them had them test the violins in a hotel room. They say what they really need is to see how they do in a concert hall.
Yeah, but I think this is biased, because what actually happens is if a violinist is given a modern violin, and if he doesn't like it, he's going to, you know, dismiss it straight away without even bothering trying it in a larger hall. While if it's an old violin, even if he doesn't like it, he's going probably to blame himself and say, no, it's an old violin, it's a good violin, has to work on it. And then he's going to work on it. Sometimes it may take him even a year. And then he will decide that he's going to like it. But a modern violin, if he doesn't like it under the ear, is not going to take it to a large hall to try it further. So I think it's, I understand the point. Obviously, the result in a small room and in a large room are most likely to be different. Not necessarily completely different, because there is always this first step. A violinist will try it under his ear. And if he likes it, then wants to try it in a large hall. So I think it's not necessarily a big issue for our study.
Do you think, Nicholas Wade, that the violinists that you spoke with were trying to defend their investments?
Well, that could well be the case. The more you pay for a picture, the more you value it. So I think it's hard for anyone to be objective in this realm. And so that's why Claudia's study is so important.
So, Ms. Fritz, do you intend to do further studies of this kind and sort of debunk the idea that a Stradivarius is worth $20 million?
Yes, I'd love to. Actually, I would love to do a second study where this time people would have the opportunity to play first in a small room and then in a large audience. That would be really good. But the problem is, like, how can I get this highly expensive violins for at least a week or even two if I want to do it in two halls? And that's why we only did it in one venue, because just we had the violins for 3 days, and in 3 days we had to fit as many players as we could. So I'm happy to do it in a large hall, and if people really think that their Strad is much better than any other instrument, they can come to see me and I'd be happy to test it.
Maybe you could get a crowd of concert goers who would love to hear them test their violins in a concert hall.
Yes.
So, Nicholas Wade, the mystery goes on then.
Yes, I think so. It's a very interesting beginning that Claudia has made, and I think other people will be very interested in following it up.
Well, thank you both. Nicholas Wade at The New York Times and Ms. Fritz at the Pierre and Marie Curie University in Paris. Good to have both of you on our programs. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Andrea Brody and Christian Bordahl. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.